Welcome to Southeast Native Radio. Tonight we present part two in a series of discussions with Fred Paul about the struggle for Native civil rights in Southeast Alaska. Fred Paul has written a book about the subject entitled Then Fight For It, which will be published later this winter. Andy Hope is asking the questions.
I'm interested in how you treat the Indian Reorganization Act and how it was applied to Alaska in your book.
I've always felt that the Alaska extension of the IRA to Alaska was very, very worthwhile. Today we talk about traditional councils, but in 1936, traditional councils didn't exist. Of course they did, but not in a recognized fashion. So there was no competition or comparison between the two types of organizations. The IRA gave a structure to a tribe. It would include recognition by the federal government that a tribe was, in fact, a tribe. When a white man deals with a tribe, all he sees is an amorphous can of worms. And of course, in Indian culture, we had no such thing as a chief in the sense of a dictator. We had the chairman of a council. And it was a true democracy in the sense that if a member of the tribe didn't agree with the leader, he went about his own business and let the leader do whatever he wanted to do. Didn't bother him any. So you find the spokesman for a particular tribe would say, this is our policy, and then you'd find somebody who didn't agree with it, and maybe he'd speak up, or maybe he wouldn't, or maybe he wouldn't support it, or wouldn't show up for meetings. So the white men said, it's impossible to deal with, as I say, an amorphous can of worms. The Indian Reorganization Act gave a structure, something that the white men could understand, a banker or a government or city council. You had a majority vote, and the IRA would pass a resolution, and it became the policy of that tribe. Therefore, there was some stability as to a policy. The extension to the to Alaska, the IRA, had two provisions. One, groups could organize as an IRA entity, usually called a tribe, but not necessarily. Secondly, it gave the Secretary of the Interior authority to create reservations out of the public domain. And of course, as of then, all of Alaska was treated as a public domain, all 375 million acres. Then the IRA has also paid no federal, territorial, or local taxes. Well, in business, if you have the tax advantage of financial advantage of not having to pay taxes, hey, you can run a pretty inefficient organization and still make a profit. Lately, income taxes have been reduced from 48% for corporations, 48% of their profit, but even with the Reagan tax cut, you're still looking at, call it 33% tax advantage on your gross profit. An enormous advantage. Then, and under that phase of the extension to the IRA to Alaska, the Indian office had a revolving fund, a loan fund, and four canneries were established in Southeast, and a couple hundred boats were purchased with this revolving fund by the local IRAs, all of which were beneficial. Then in the to the westward, 85 or 90 trading stores were established, all of which were most helpful. And the IRA stores to the westward of Alaska had a great advantage because the Bureau of Indian Affairs freighter would bring in the year's supplies for the stores, and thereby beat competition price-wise. Well, the concept is, in my judgment as of then and still, is that IRA was very, very beneficial. Reservations were created. Venati has 1.4 million acres. Taonic was created. Elam out of Nome was created. A little reservation out of Clequan was created, 1,000 acres or thereabouts. Secretary of the Interior, he was going to create more. But that was a controversy that really came to blossom a few years later. The structure of the IRAs throughout the whole state, the whole territory, was that villages were the recognized entity for the creation of an IRA. The Pauls were never in favor of a village structure of an IRA. We wanted regional IRAs. But the Indian office wouldn't permit that. It would give the Indians too much power, and thereby the Indians would be bossing the Bureau rather than the Bureau bossing the Indians. And in the Tlingit and the Haida country, with their four canneries and a couple hundred boats, financed by this revolving fund under the IRA, being run, at least in name, by a village, the leadership was simply too weak to fight the BIA. One device the BIA used was, in the canvas situation, they would claim all of the proceeds of the canned salmon product to repay the loan. Then you had to reapply during the winter for a new loan, which meant that unless you bowed to the dictates of the government and the management, you wouldn't get an operating loan for next year's season. But even as to the amount of local control that the BIA permitted the local council to exercise, we're still, even today, somewhat influenced by traditional culture. In the Tlingit world, the mother's brother, the uncle, was the source of all authority in the rearing of a child. And in the olden days, went to live with the uncle. The father was not that important. The Tlingits are matrilineal. They trace their ancestry through their mother. So the father is necessary, I guess, for procreation, but beyond that has little influence in a family. So here you have an IRA on the council, and an uncle's on the board, and his favorite nephew wants a boat. Whether the nephew is worthwhile or not, doesn't matter. He is the nephew. So you have a lot of improvident loans. And, of course, with improvident loans, the BIA says you have to, you're not competent to run your own affairs. Not realizing, or maybe with malice aforethought, realizing that the village structure made the IRA doomed to failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their boat loans, for example, the BIA said you have to start small. Get a small boat, and if you can make payments on your loan, you get a bigger boat. Well, it meant, they're small boats. I think the maximum loan to begin with was, I've forgotten whether it was $1,500 or $3,500. But let's call it 3,500. Every old wreck that had been on that beach for 10 or 15 years was painted up, caulked up a little bit, and the engine was sparked up a little bit. It became worth $3,500, even though in a few matter of weeks or, you know, it's going to fall apart. Now, there isn't a native alive, whether in Southeast or wherever, who does not want a boat. And even if it's an old wreck, he wants a boat. And particularly when he doesn't have to put up a penny.
Mm-hmm.
All he has to do is sign some papers and walk onto the boat and away he goes. So basically the IRA program was a failure. The last figures I have documented, I think, is around 1969, and as of then, and I'm sure they're not better today, but as of then, the IRA program in Southeast owed on this revolving fund some $19 million. A lot of it may be interest, but a lot of it principal. Then the canneries were sort of a source of I can call it misconduct. Some of the cannery superintendents were fine people. Others weren't. I can remember one of the cannery superintendents, I won't mention his name, but he's pressed I could, was an old drunk. Well, he kept his job very easily. Members of the council, or the influential members of the council, the village council, would get favored treatment. When such a person had a load of fish, the cannery tender was there ready to pick it up and take it to the cannery. There was no delay. Or if council member's boat needed a new motor, new engine, hey, he got it. In other words, the cannery superintendent gave favors. And of course he's going to be supported. But again, the structure of the IRA was faulty. There mm-hmm. should have been regions.
We're listening to Fred Paul on Southeast Native Radio as he discusses the history of Native civil rights in Southeast Alaska. This program is part two of a three-part series.
Your participation in the Lincoln Hina suit from the mid-40s to the mid-50s, how did that come about?
My brother Bill got out of law school in 1939, and I got out in 1940. Bill had done his thesis in law school on the Indian Aboriginal rights in southeastern Alaska on the Jurisdictional Act. The Jurisdictional Act is an act of Congress which was passed in 1935. Authorizing the Tlingits and Haidas to sue the United States for the value of lands theretofore lost. It had nothing to do with reclaiming lands that were still in ownership by the Indians. It was a suit for money, for lands already taken. He did this thesis, and he came to the conclusion that as to what I later attributed to the whole state of Alaska, but the whole territory of the state of Alaska. But in Southeast, he came to the conclusion that the Tlingits and Haidas still owned most of the Tongass National Forest, as well as the areas outside of the National Forest, because there had never been, in his judgment, an expropriation by the Congress, a taking by the Congress of the Tlingit and Haida Aboriginally held lands. All of this, you know, I document in my book,
mm-hmm.
then fight for it. Well, the 1935 Act, Donald Long, we had a big convention in 1935, nothing happened. And the ANB and my father, with my brother Bill's my help, tried to get things moving. And in 1941, we had a big convention at Wrangell. And at this convention, the Klingon Haida people, which is specially called through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bill and I were appointed as the lawyers for the we didn't call it the Central Council in those days. It was the Klingon Haida Indians of Alaska. Well, lawyers can't represent Indian tribes without the approval of the Secretary of Interior. So we sent back a standard form of contract, and to this day it's never been acted upon. Well, which meant that were we to represent the Indian tribe, we could never be paid. Well, we got impatient, Bill and I did, and we filed an action on behalf of the Klingon Haidas in the Court of Claims, proper court, which the court dismissed because of our lack of authority to represent the tribe on the motion by the United States Department of Justice. All right, so we're stymied. So my father wrote to the National Congress of American Indians. I think Mrs. Peterson was then the head honcho, and she recommended a guy by the name of James E. Curry, who was then a darling of the Washington office of the BIA. So Curry and Bill and I submitted a contract signed by the Klingon Haida Indians, and we signed it and sent it back, and we got approval. Jim Curry was the chief counsel, and Bill and I were the associate counsel. So in 1947, we filed our action, which later blossomed into the Klingon Haida case, resulting in a 1959 decision and a 1968 decision, favorable to the Indians. Curry soon burned out. Senator Anderson got angry at him and attacked him, and Curry fell out of favor of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So Curry farmed the case out to I.S. Weisskrot, known as Lefty. And Lefty's a pretty able lawyer, mm-hmm. Really pretty able lawyer. But Bill and I had a disagreement with him as to the philosophy, the management of the case. We felt that there had never been a taking of the Klingon Haida lands, except as to individual timber contracts. I'll explain that in a moment. Lefty argued that the Tongass National Forest Proclamation itself, back in 1903, there were a bunch of them, but call it 1907, was a taking by the United States, thereby depriving the Klingon Haidas of any ownership. Mm-hmm. In the 16 million acres of the Tongass National Forest. We felt that the proclamation was not a taking, but rather the issuance of a timber contract by the Forest Service, stumpage contract, that was the taking. And the Department of Justice urged that our view was right. Lefty's view prevailed. I don't know what would have happened had Lefty endorsed our idea and endorsed the idea presented by the Department of Justice, what the court would have done. I have a belief that our view would have prevailed in the court, but whatever. When the Klingon Haida case was actually tried on the issue of damages, it was tried on the theory that the expropriation, the taking, was as of the date of the proclamation back in 1907. Well, what was the timber of Southeast worth in 1907? Probably nothing, because there was no market. In any event, the court awarded, I think, 40 cents an acre. Well, now you can't buy a twig for 40 cents in the Tongass National Forest today. Now, if our view had prevailed that most of the Tongass National Forest was still in Indian possession, as of the time of taking, which would have been after 1968, maybe as a part of the Settlement Act, the measure of damages, the measure of value, would be as of the time of that latter taking, call it 1970 values. And the award to the Tlingits and Haidas would have been 100 times more than what it was. $7.6 million dollars for 16 million acres of the Tongass National Forest, you know, is plain robbery. Mm-hmm. It's plain thievery. But that's what the court held. As long as we're talking about the King and Heidi case, we should talk about the impact on the fisheries in that case. The 59 decision was pretty good. It held that the Tlingit and Haidas owned a right of fishery in Southeast, as well as the land and the timber and some mineral resources. And the court said, we will appoint some hearing examiners to determine the value of the land that the Indians have lost. Value of fisheries, value of the timber, value of these mineral resources. Okay, so that brings us down to 1968. And the hearing examiner determined that, I think it was some $15 million was due. Lo and behold, the 68 decision said that the Indians, Southeast Indians, owned no fisheries. They held that there could be no right of ownership in a fishery. Therefore, that part of that decision was thrown out, leaving only the timber. And that's why the judgment in the Tlingit and Haida case in 1968 was $7.6 million. Well, I had a conversation with Lefty Westbrook shortly after the decision came out. I said, Lefty, did you cite those Hawaiian cases? No, I didn't. Quote, unquote. The Hawaiian decisions held that under the monarchy of Hawaii, the aborigines there had a right of ownership in the fisheries, both by royal grant, but also from custom. Mm-hmm. The two decisions were both written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. If somebody wants to look them up, the name of the cases are Damon versus Hawaii and Carter versus Hawaii around 1900, shortly after Hawaii was acquired by the United States. So I said, Lefty, did you cite the State of Washington treaty cases? No, I didn't. Well, the significance of that is that a treaty is a grant of land to the United States, reserving in the tribes that which was not conveyed. So, you know, Judge Bolt's decision in the State of Washington is well known. And Judge Bolt held that the Indian tribes in the State of Washington own, for all practical purposes, 50% of the fish as they come in. And that includes mussels and clams and crabs and halibut and salmon, whatever. Well, now, if you have no right of ownership in a fishery ever within the laws of the United States, then a treaty would not be a recognition of such ownership of such rights. In other words, before a treaty tribe can have a right of fishery surviving the treaty, it has to be owned before the treaty. In other words, Aboriginal rights.
Mm-hmm.
So that the treaty cases are direct authority, as well as the Hawaiian cases, that there is such a thing in American law of a right to own a fishery.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 68 Court of Claims to say there was no right of fishery, there could not be a right of fishery in the in any place within the United States, is totally wrong. But of course, you have a right of appeal. So when the 68 decision came out, there was a big convention at Angoon as to what they were going to do with this. This terrible decision, only $7.6 million dollars. And Weisbrot convinced the delegates there that they should let well enough alone and take the money and run. They didn't even apply for a rehearing, let alone apply for an appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, today we have a great sovereignty issue. The natives up here are envious of what's happening down in the state of Washington, and God bless them, they're right. No problem. I endorse it. But here we have a decision relating to Alaska, the Klingenhardt decision in 1968, which holds that it's impossible to have a private right of fishery in the United States. It applies to Alaska. How can, our adversaries argue, how can the people in the Kenai Peninsula or Bristol Bay or Yukon River or wherever have any pretensions that they have a God-given right of private fishery? Here's a court decision, and there were seven judges in that court. Here's a court decision that says you can't.
Mm-hmm.
All because I can't say that the Klingits and Hatters would have won on the appeal, but I can say they didn't try to appeal.
Mm-hmm.
There it is.
You've been listening to Southeast Native Radio. Tonight's program was part two of a conversation with Fred Paul concerning the history of Native civil rights in Southeast Alaska. The third and final part of this series with Fred Paul can be heard next week over this public radio station. This program was produced in the studios of KTOO-FM, Juneau.